Hello, everybody, and welcome. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. I am Francis Schott here with Mark Pascal. We own Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick, and we are here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. Listen to us every day from 11 a.m. to 12 noon, and check us out through our fabulous website, www.restaurantguysradio.com. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
Just Ducky. No, that's you.
What are we going to talk about today, Mark?
I say we talk about cocktails.
Cocktails.
It's a little early to talk about them, but by the end of the show, it'll be noon, and we can start having cocktails.
You know, they say it's noon somewhere. It's always noon somewhere.
Well, thank goodness for daylight savings time. We've sprung ahead, so it's an hour closer to cocktail time.
You know, I missed that this weekend.
Would you just slept right there?
I was an hour behind for, like, the first half of the day. I showed up to my family later.
That's
Easter
good. It's
once.
Usually, like, Wednesday that
yeah,
you catch
I know.
Up.
Well, but
I'm glad you're here today.
The sad thing was nobody noticed because I'm always late anyway. Like, oh, it's 3? Oh, look at that.
So let's see a great profession for you, radio show host, for somebody who's never on time. Excellent.
I'm always there in time for cocktails. So let's talk about cocktails,
okay.
Mark. Do you drink a lot of cocktails?
I actually love to start a meal with cocktail.
You know,
so it's one of my favorite ways to start a meal or end a really, really late night. With a cocktail in a special little place.
With sing at a smoky club somewhere. When you were younger, though, what was the cocktail? What was your cocktail experience?
Cocktails? When we were in college?
Yeah.
We were drinking Alabama Slammers and slow, comfortable screws and all sorts of ridiculous things meant to get you drunk without tasting alcohol.
Ladies and gentlemen, the cocktail revolution has taken place. And the cocktail revolution is largely... due to the efforts of one man, a guy named Dale DeGroff. Now, it's due to the efforts of a lot of people, but the godfather of the cocktail in America.
Most of them disciples of Dale, though. I mean, almost all those people are disciples of Dale.
All the ones from the Northeast, certainly. Mm-hmm. But I mean, Dale really helped to salvage cocktail, which is a uniquely American invention. I mean, the cocktail was invented in America. It had its height during... Prohibition and thereafter it became sort of unfashionable in the 70s and into mm-hmm. the 80s, where it went in through the like all American food, we went from real bread to Wonder Bread, and now we're back at artisanal and
right.
real breads. But I do remember when I was my first experience with the cocktail when I was 19 years old, I was in a club called Creations.
Blackberry Sour?
No. I was drinking Mudslides, and it was my first experience with cocktails, and I was at a Chaka Khan concert, believe it or not. And I was dancing, you know, at Creations in West Orange on the mountain.
So Mudslide could be the best thing that happened to you, though.
Oh, my God. You know what happens after you've had, like, 7 Mudslides?
You go to bed.
You've eaten a quart of ice cream, and it's time to go to bed. But the cocktail has really changed. I have to say, I was one of those sort of retro 22-year-olds. I remember, I know, you think I'm a dork, but
yeah.
I used to like Bobby Short, who passed away just recently, sadly, and I was drinking martinis and Manhattans as a 22-year-old, and everybody thought I was a dork, but I could hold my liquor better than they could. But the cocktail has really changed. I remember when we first started bartending.
But you're still a dork.
Well, you know, but the world's coming around to my vision of dorkdom. But I remember when we started bartending, I mean, it was, you know... A stale old bottle of bitters was behind the bar that nobody
yeah,
used.
Yeah, the bitters was 25 years old. You know my first bartending job?
Right.
There was an old cocktail called an old fashioned.
Mm-hmm.
And my very first bartending job, I was working at a place up in North Jersey. And the guy who trained me to bartend said, I said, you know, what if somebody orders an old fashioned? Just tell them you don't have bitters and tell them you can't make it. That was the policy of the place. Now, there's a jar of bitters under there that had been there for 15 years. But they were, you know, it was a cocktail that took a little bit of time and a little bit of craft. And so...
And you had to know how to make it.
And so the policy was, that takes too much time. We're not doing it.
What's funny is I didn't go to bartending school. And one of the best jobs I ever had, I was bartender for 6 years. I loved it. And then I bartended in our own place, and so did you for a while.
Mm-hmm.
I love being a bartender for a lot of reasons. You're a real locus of community when you bartend in a small city like New Brunswick. And I really cared about cocktails, but I didn't know where to go. And I didn't know quite how to make them. Now, I became a wine guy, you know, and you became a beer guy. You may not know this out there in the listening land, but Mark is a real expert on beer, particularly Belgian beer. And when I looked to what to do with cocktails, my friend Joanne went to bartending school, and she came home with this book of all these cocktails, and she knew how to make like 80 cocktails.
There were all Sex on the Beach.
They were awful. I mean, just awful. And
they tasted like fake raspberries or Jolly Ranchers. Actually, that was the name of one of the drinks, the Jolly Rancher, that was supposed to taste like a piece of corn syrup candy. That's what it was supposed to taste like.
There was an old quote by Mencken, H.L. Mencken, said something like, and I don't have it off the top of my head, something like, the cocktail is the finest contribution of the American way of life to the culture of the world, or something like that. And then Bill Grimes, who before he became the New York Times restaurant critic, wrote a book called Straight Up or On the Rocks, A Cultural History of American Drink. And he said something like, he quoted Mencken, and they said, it's a good thing Mencken didn't live to see. Such abominations as the fuzzy, wuzzy, woo-woo, you know? and there are really two schools of cocktail, and where it's gone from these cocktails that were, you know, what happened to cocktails is what happened to food. We went from, you know, having a bunch of small bakers that made our bread every day to getting Wonder Bread and food out of a can. Mm-hmm. And now we're again looking for real food.
We're trying to find somebody who makes their own bread every day.
And to preserve the traditions and the quality. And what's happening now is you're seeing people like Dale DeGroff and like great bartenders all around come up with cocktails of their own and try to preserve our history. But more importantly, like great chefs, they look for great ingredients. They look for balance. They look, you know, there's one bartender in New York who coined the phrase bar chef, and it was really apropos because he was, a lot of care went into these things. And you weren't throwing out, you know, 37 screwdrivers and 25 beers every couple of minutes.
That was a town, right?
Yeah, it was a guy named Albert Trummer who coined the phrase bar chef, who also knows Dale. Well, we're going to have Dale on right after the first break, and we'll talk to him more about these cocktails as we go forward. But to see what's happening with the cocktail is really great, and it's exciting. But, you know, like great art, you know, there are people take chances, and everybody's got a quote-unquote martini menu or a cocktail menu, and some people really go awry.
Some of the cocktails out there
are terrible.
Where you have the same kind of thing that you had in the 70s and 80s, people are experimenting to such a level that they're going over the top, and people's cocktails aren't balanced. And we're going to talk to Dale some more about balancing cocktails and what makes a really good cocktail.
Well, and I also think it's people who aren't sufficiently schooled to take, I mean, whether it's by reading or by learning, to go and work with fresh juices and fresh ingredients and great things, and they throw, you know, some Buca Grand Marnier and Frangelico together and shake it up with some cream. And, you know, it's new. You know, I've created something new. But the question is why. But if you haven't had great cocktails and gone to some great cocktail places, and we'll recommend some later, you really haven't seen what cocktails can do.
We'll talk about this later, too. But I went someplace recently, and they did the inexcusable. Juice out of a gun.
Oh, my.
So they're coming, a concentrated thing that sits around for 4 months. We'll talk about that more later.
You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. We're going to be talking with Dale DeGroff, author of The Craft of the Cocktail and a noted American bartender. Central Jersey, 1450. Time is 11:15.
You're back with The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Today's guest is going to be Dale DeGroff, author of The Craft of the Cocktail and really the father, the messiah of cocktails in this country right now.
Oh, messiah, are you with us? Dale? Hello, Dale.
Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
All right.
Welcome to the show, Dale.
I'm happy to be here.
We're here to talk about cocktails with you, Dale. This is something that you know a lot about.
I'm very happy to talk about cocktails.
Do you ever get to talk about them, Dale?
What's that?
Do you ever get to talk about cocktails?
So seldom. About 13 hours a day.
Well, let's talk about the present, about what's going on right now. You have a pretty exciting project that you told me about before it came to be, and it was just an idea, and now it exists. It's called the Museum of the Cocktail.
Yeah, it's actually the dream of my wife, who would like me to get all of the junk that I've collected in the house out of the house. If you create a museum, I can ship it all out, and she gets to live in New Orleans.
Wives across the listening area have come up with ideas like, the Museum of Baseball Garbage. Yeah. Let's see.
The Museum of Old Trophies.
The Bowling Trophy Museum.
So, well, anyway, we did manage to get the thing open in a temporary location down in the French Quarter of New Orleans above the Pharmacy Museum, an existing museum on Charter Street. We're good there through October 1st, but right now we're scrambling to find our second temporary location while we negotiate and search out our permanent location. There are many possibilities for that, including the U.S. Mint Building in the French Quarter, among others.
But it will stay in New Orleans, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
If somebody wants to give us the top floor of the Chrysler Building, we're there.
for $600 a month.
Exactly.
Now, Dale, you have some heavy hitters behind you in this thing. I mean, there are some real people that are backing
Absolutely.
And supporting the museum.
Top people in the industry and people that are not really deeply in the industry but are cocktail geeks, you want to say?
Right.
But also authors in their own right. We have Dr. Cocktail, Ted Hay from Los Angeles, who's really by day a movie designer and a very good one.
Mm-hmm.
Works on seriously important films. But he's by night an author and a cocktail geek and one of the real true historians of the cocktail, Ted Hay. And we have Robert Hess, who by day is a group manager for Microsoft in Seattle.
Uh-huh.
But by night operates probably the most interesting chat room worldwide for professional bartenders as well as amateurs called drinkboy.com.
Nice.
Really? We'll put that up on our website later on.
So it sounds like all these people are doing something during the day and kind of coming out at night to
yes.
get involved with their cocktail dreams.
Yes, they're sort of part-time cocktail missionaries. Robert is an interesting character because he's managed to put together a forum which has become, for international bartenders, a real source of information and a real resource, because the site not only has chat, it has archived on it all kinds of information like where to buy things,
mm-hmm.
spirit tastings, what's out there, recipes, and it's connected to another great site called CocktailDB.com, which simply means cocktail database, which has an incredible recipe library, and it's connected to my site, kingcocktail.com. So there's within that little family, there's a lot of information for young bartenders out there. Because you know something, guys? There is no place for these guys to go to school. There's
mm-hmm.
no CIA of bartending. There's no Johnson and Wales of mixology.
Right.
It just doesn't exist.
Yeah, we were fortunate enough when we first opened. Dale came in and did a class for you know our staff and kind of got everybody rolling into the cocktail thing right away. But that's really unusual. There aren't many people out there like you, and you know you're hard to find.
There's a half a dozen of us crisscross the country teaching young bartenders, and it's going to take a lot of years to put a dent in a profession that was badly damaged by prohibition, and to this day I don't think really recovered to the level of respect and accomplishment that it had prior to prohibition, when it was really a serious profession and more of a these. You look at the 19th century bar books and you realize that these bartenders in the 19th century were not just beverage transporters. These guys were almost chemists. They were making
mm-hmm.
a lot of their own bitters and syrups. There was a lot of on-premise production, and it was a serious job.
For those of you who just tuned in, you're listening to The Restaurant Guys talking to Dale DeGroff, author of The Craft of the Cocktail and a founding member of the Cocktail Museum, and he was also the original cocktail, probably the most important man in the cocktail revolution in the United States when he was behind the bar at the Rainbow Room for his run from, what was that, 87 to 97, Dale?
Well, 87 to 99 actually was when we closed.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Christmas Eve, New Year's Eve, 99.
You know, it's funny, you talk about the barman being a profession, you know, and, you know, it's more than, it's, and I think our focus is on cocktails today, but it was more about, it was as much about being a locus of community, about being a place to go,
mm-hmm.
and the barman held an important role in the society, don't you think, Dale?
Oh, sure. I mean, the whole evolution of the cocktail bar and the cocktail bartender really finds its roots in the middle of the 19th century when these bars were political and community centers,
mm-hmm.
And the bar owners were community leaders, and they were probably the guys who were, you know, in the days of Tammany Hall, handing out the patronage. If your family was down on its luck, that was where you got a loan.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever you needed, you went to that guy. He was the community leader, and it was also because the men were gathering these places, and the men were the only ones who were allowed to vote, it was a power center as well.
Right.
So there was a lot going on in the bars.
Well, and it also, it varied by ethnic community. I mean, they were the barmen, especially in the Irish communities and even in the Italian communities, would all, you know, they would be sort of the locus of that ethnic place because that's where those people would go to gather.
Completely, yeah. And the politicos tried to keep a hand in all of them so that they could keep a sort of a sphere of influence in each of these different ethnic neighborhoods. And they did that through the saloons.
And one of the things that's interesting about, we were talking the other day about bars that have televisions in them, you know, and one of the things that's interesting is prior to television, and, you know, most of the bars that I really like to go to obviously don't have televisions in them. And one of the reasons is because you talk to each other.
People got together. That's where you talked about social issues. That's where you shared all the information about what your crops were doing, about what, you know, all those kinds of things got shared in a bar.
Oh, God, yeah. Even when I moved to New York in 1969, it's interesting. In 1969, real estate hadn't gone so crazy, and those East Side neighborhoods were still peppered with 5 and 6 saloons per block. Of course, it's not the same anymore. They're either high-end stores or they're something else, but they're not what they used to be.
When we come back,
I caught the end of that. Those bars, some of them were 100 years old.
When we come back from a short break, Dale, we want to talk to you about what's happened to New York and what's happened to those old bars and sort of the downtime and the emergence of the new joint as it's come up across the country. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, talking with Dale DeGroff, author of Craft of the Cocktail and noted international bartender. Central Jersey, 1450 time is 1125.
Hello and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark Pascal and Francis Schott. Today we're here with Dale DeGroff, who is author of the book The Craft of the Cocktail and kind of the father of the whole new cocktail revolution that's retaking the country. Dale, we were talking just a couple minutes ago about the fall of the joint and the re-rise of the joint as they've kind of come back into fashion and are coming back to New York.
You know, Mark, I think it falls in line with what happened to this sort of evolution of the cocktail in America. It's not like the cocktail ever went away. I mean, the cocktail is so much a part, a fabric of the American culture, so much a part of that fabric, I mean, that it would never really go away. What happened during Prohibition, it was just difficult to get a decent cocktail. What happened. People didn't stop drinking. They just drank more. They drank poorly.
They drank what was made in the bathtub.
Yes, exactly. And after Prohibition, the problem, of course, was that there wasn't skilled labor, and so there began a procession of these products that were designed to sort of be an insurance policy against lack of skilled labor, and that's what we got stuck with in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, is all these awful mixes and guns, and of course, the redesigning of ice in the last 25 years.
I like the way you used the expression, stuck with.
Yeah. You know, the redesigning of ice by the Japanese over the last 25 or 30 years has also further eroded the quality of the cocktail, but... And then the generation that I grew up in, and I'm 56, that whole dropout generation didn't buy into the whole cocktail culture, but their children did.
Right.
And that's what we're seeing now. They're going back to the cocktail lounge of their grandparents and their great-grandparents, and so we're seeing, sure, more and more of these stylish, wonderful 30s deco-looking lounges all over the country. Here in New York, you know, the Flatiron Lounge and Employees Only and all these cool places that are opening. And the rebirth of the Bemelman's Bar from a sleepy old man's afternoon hangout to a real cool
scene. That's in the Carlisle Hotel on the Upper East Side, yeah.
Yeah, so it's when I first came to town in 69, those neighborhood bars were all there, and they were like our living rooms.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those neighborhood bars are still out there, and they still are our living rooms because we live in these little boxes.
Yeah, you know, and watch a little box all day long instead of talking to people.
You know, it's funny. We look to New York. They say, I mean, many of the cocktails have been written about New York, say that the reason that the saloon culture was so important in New York and has always been more important in New York than anywhere else. And the reason we looked to New York to lead us in the direction of bars and cocktails is because real estate has always been so tight in New York that people don't entertain in their homes. You meet somebody at your local, you know, and so it further becomes a locus of community.
I mean, our extended families are the patrons. A lot of people come to New York and they're alone in New York because they've left Oklahoma. They've left their families behind.
Right.
And they create new families, and those families are what they find in their neighborhood saloons.
Mm-hmm. And even if they find a new family somewhere else, where do you meet? I mean, you're not going to go to the bowling alley and meet. You know, you're not in the same PTA anymore.
And you don't fit in your living room.
Exactly.
As far as the quality of the cocktail, I'm sure.
Actually, Dale, you know what? We need to take a quick break for the news, but when we come back, and I do want you to come back, I want to talk about the quality of the cocktail, which is really amazing what's happened in the last few years. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450, time is 1130. You're back with The Restaurant Guys. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. I am Francis Schott, and I'm here with Mark Pascal. We own Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick, and we're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. Listen to us every day from 11 a.m. to 12 noon, or you can reach us through restaurantguysradio.com. We're here today talking with Dale DeGroff, founding member of the Museum of the American Cocktail, author of The Craft of the Cocktail, and probably the preeminent bartender in America, Mr. DeGroff.
And a really good storyteller.
Great to be here, Francis, Mark. I'm serious.
We were talking about, you were, right before the news, we started talking about how, we talked about how the joints have changed, how the bars have changed. But one of the things that's interesting is how the quality of the actual food, the drinks themselves have changed. And why don't you talk to us about what's happened since the nadir of the 60s and 70s?
Let me take a cocktail that we all know, the Tequila Sunrise.
It's okay.
Probably the way most people my age were introduced to tequila, not through the margarita, but through the Tequila Sunrise.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going through my old Roving Bartender, 1948, by Bill Kelly, and I stumble upon the first mention of tequila in a cocktail book that I've seen, because I've looked for earlier mentions, and there are none earlier than 1948 recipe books. So I look at the recipe for the Tequila Sunrise, and it's the following recipe. Fresh-made lemonade with a shot of tequila, and the sunrise effect is created by pouring cassis down through the drink. And I'm thinking to myself, wow.
Sounds delicious.
Wow. And then I think of what we call a tequila sunrise, orange juice with this gluey grenadine pouring down through the drink.
Right, right, right.
And I think, so I went back and tried that recipe, and cassis and tequila is one of those fabulous matches that I never thought about. And that drink has gone from there to the drink we know today. Now it's going back to
right.
its origins.
If someone wants a classically made Tequila Sunrise, we're going to make them tonight at Stage Left.
There you go.
Absolutely. And you can mix the old recipe and the new by doing a half lemonade, half orange, and that's great, too.
Nice.
One of the things, Dale, that we remember is when we started working in bars, you go behind the bar, there wouldn't be any bitters. The bitters would be stale if it was there. And if you had juice, you had, like, the cheapest food service juice that was, like, it got shipped to the bar and the school lunch program, you know?
Exactly.
And then,
you know what kills me is people, they say, oh, we don't drink martinis, you know. And one reason why they don't is because, especially in the home, but in bars as well, they'll have these bottles of vermouth that have been there for decades.
Yeah.
Right, vermouth is wine, is made out of wine.
Wine. And, it, yeah. you know, they say, oh, I don't like vermouth in my martini anymore. Of course you don't like it in your martini anymore. Taste the vermouth, it's gone.
Right, I don't like stale old vermouth in my martini either.
Right, but the ingredient is so critical. To see a classy bar that will turn around and use real substandard cordials, for example, that are just basically sugar, artificially
mm-hmm.
sugared water.
Right.
And think that they're making a good cocktail when they have great vodkas and great whiskeys, and then they'll throw this awful mixture into it because there's no thought about that. Oh, we can save money here. They're not thinking about the taste and the flavor. Like Julia Child said, what wine do you cook with? You cook with the best wine you can afford to cook with.
Right, right,
right.
Exactly.
And sure, there might be 30 cents of ingredients that you're talking about, which, you know.
Well, I think that, you know, what's interesting is I think the ingredients on one level, I mean, you go into more bars, and when you go into serious bars these days, they make their own juice. They juice lemons. They juice limes. Mm-hmm. They don't use... You know, Rose's lime juice has a very specific application, and it's not the same as fresh lime juice.
Yeah.
You know?
It's not a margarita lime juice.
Right, exactly.
Well, it's sweetened. I mean, just for that alone.
Exactly.
Well, so, but I what I think is interesting is, number one, when bars squeeze their own juices, it makes all the difference in the world. I mean, we get so crazy when I go to a real cocktail bar, when we do a cocktail dinner with you, Dale, we don't use, you know, those, I don't like those spin juicers. I don't know about you, the juicers that spin around and you put the orange thing on it. I like a pressed juicer because it seems to me that you get less pith and more sweet juice.
And the pith is bitter and the juice is sweet, so.
It's true. At the Rainbow Room, we had no alternative but to use the Sunkissed Power Juicer, but
mm-hmm.
my Marbacks were instructed on how to use it. The Sunkissed Power Juicer is somewhere in between the big industrial ones and the smaller kitchen ones.
Uh-huh.
It's a good one because it doesn't bite too deeply into the pith.
Right.
It's got a plastic head on it, and it won't eat into the white unless you push really, really hard. The commercial juices that you buy supposedly, quote-unquote, fresh squeezed, like
right.
fresh squeezed lemon and lime that are frozen and sent to you, they are, in fact, fresh squeezed, but the problem is that those commercial juices really eat deeply into the pith. And when you get that juice and thaw it out, you'll notice that there's a white the whole lower third is white and the top third is the clear juice.
Mm-hmm.
If you were able to decant that juice off the white stuff, you might get a decent tasting juice. But of course, you shake it up, and what you're shaking up is all the white pith back into the juice.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you know, but you know what's interesting? I always look at juices like that, and I think to myself, oh yeah, it was fresh squeezed. Everything was fresh once, okay?
Right.
Like, it's like the term fresh frozen. It was fresh when we froze it. Yeah, but then you froze it, and it's not fresh anymore. You know? What is as opposed to, like, rotten frozen, the people who, like, let it rot and then freeze it?
I'll tell you, though.
The exception I would make to that rule is what the pastry chef will use to make sorbet, and that's something called flash frozen fresh fruit puree.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Those are very clean and very fruit-flavored, and they're captured at the moment of freshness.
And you're also putting it into something you're going to be freezing,
yeah.
Dale. So, yeah. Clearly you can put a frozen product into something you're freezing.
Well, I actually use those in cocktails a lot quite successfully, mm-hmm. When I want to get exotic fruits, which I don't and cannot afford to puree myself.
I'm going to tell you, I the other day went to borrow some orange juice from another restaurant. We were out of oranges, went to borrow some orange juice from another restaurant, and I'm not going to tell you the name of the restaurant, but I was embarrassed for this restaurant. They said, oh, you need orange juice? And they took the gun out, and they pressed the gun and filled up a container of orange juice for me.
How do you feel about that, Dale?
You know, I said thank you and went to borrow oranges from another restaurant, I graciously received the thing they were giving to me and being very nice about. But, you know, how can you make a cocktail out of something that tastes that bad?
I know. I am a missionary of fresh juice, as you know, and I had an experience with the flagship of the Marriott Marquis here in New York. I've been doing training for some time for them, and I was just so embarrassed for the bartenders and for the customers when I trained in fresh juice, but then they would go back behind the bar, and they had these guns, and out of the gun came this sort of neon green sour mix.
Right.
Across the board.
Sour mix is a classic thing.
Yeah, they used it for everything from a whiskey sour to a margarita, which of course then creates a homogenized flavor.
But all drinks taste the same.
They taste exactly the same. Sometimes you can't even tell whether it's...
Unfortunately, the same is bad.
It's bad. And I managed to finally convince these guys at the food and beverage level that this had to change, and we did change it over. And it was quite a complex operation, and I have to say to other restaurateurs, and I don't know if they're listening. You probably have mostly regular folks listening. But it's not an easy changeover. It's a lot easier to do it in your home.
Mm-hmm.
Make a fresh fruit drink. And
sure.
That's what I think to everyone in the home.
Well, yeah, I mean, stick a fork in an orange and squeeze the orange. I mean, that's it.
Yeah, but if you're making many, many cocktails in the course of an evening, there are even a lot of these cocktail bars, especially in Jersey. In New York, if you tried this, people would laugh you out of town. But a lot of these places in Jersey will open up as a cocktail bar. And they will use, they won't make fresh juice.
Right.
They'll use, substandard
ingredients.
They think they're
doing great things when they open up the Tropicana jar.
Yeah.
Well, and, one of the interesting things when we talked about product, I think a clear example of that is with the almost ubiquitous cocktail now, the Cosmopolitan.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the cheap way out, this is, you can't use Rose's lime juice. You can't. You have to use fresh lime juice. And if you use, LaRue Triple Sec, which is, a pretty good standard bar Triple Sec, it's not going to taste the same as if you use Cointreau, which is four times more expensive, but there's a reason it's four times more expensive, because that's what makes the drink true.
When you're drinking those Cosmopolitans, and I'm talking to our listeners now, when you're drinking those Cosmopolitans and they're kind of pale in color instead of looking like there's some juice in there, that's because people are using Rose's lime juice and cheaping out. It's just a way to make that cocktail. You'll know as soon as you taste it why it's wrong.
If you can see through it, it's wrong.
Right.
Exactly. Hey, Dale, when we come back, I want to talk to you about one of your favorite subjects, which is ice and how that can go terribly awry.
Okay.
Central Jersey, 1450. Time is 11:45.
Hello and welcome back to The Restaurant Guys. You're listening to Mark Pascal and Francis Schott. Today here with Dale DeGroff, author of The Craft of the Cocktail and the father of the cocktail revolution in this country.
Quick story. When we were in a lunch club together for 10 years called the Red Meat Club, and I remember early on in the meeting, I wasn't actually at this meeting, but there's a legend that you started the tradition when you were served a Bloody Mary with what you felt was in substandard ice, that you began taking the ice out of your Bloody Mary and throwing it on the table.
We do not encourage this, everyone. We do not encourage this type of behavior.
What happens
in a restaurant.
When you do this?
Well, it's just a way of illustrating that the stuff was. I would take it between my forefinger and thumb, and I'd crush it. And if you can crush an ice cube between your forefinger and thumb, there's something seriously wrong with it.
Before we talk about.
If I did it, it would fall on the table, and so that sort of started this. Everybody, when they walk into the joint, they start tossing their ice on the table.
It was monkey see, monkey do. You know, you show me that. And so that became a tradition of the Red Meat Club. Whenever you had a Bloody Mary, you had to crush an ice cube on the table.
We were relatively obnoxious.
But so, Dale, tell us about ice, because you have really important things to say about ice. So talk to us.
Well, when I mentioned earlier in the interview that the Japanese had redesigned ice, I mean, nothing against the Japanese. They made a lot of money doing this. Don't get me wrong. What they offered the restaurateur and the institution was an ice machine that would create ice three times faster than the old cold draft. Cold mm-hmm. draft really had a monopoly on ice in this country for many, many years. Cold draft, that's spelled with a K, O-L-D-R-A-F-T, was a machine that created an ice cube in three sizes. The largest one was the big old inch-and-a-half-by-inch-and-a-half monstrosity that we had in our Scotch on the rocks back
right.
in the 50s and 60s and 70s. And it was dense and very, very cold. I know it sounds silly, but there are degrees of coldness in ice. And obviously an ice cube that is larger, denser, and colder will take longer to freeze. So these people would have to have more than one ice machine. So the owners were so happy that they could get the one ice machine and they could spit out all this mounds and mounds of ice. What they neglected to think about was what kind of ice they were getting. And what
mm-hmm.
they were getting was these trapezoids or little squares or little circles or whatever you want to talk about, and they were all warm.
I can hear the disdain in your voice,
though. Well, they were warm because they weren't frozen very long, and
right.
so the bartender, when he shakes with this ice or when he puts it in the scotch, listen, when I was tending bar for all those years, I remember in the early days, in the 70s, a scotch drinker would push that empty glass across the bar at me and say, don't touch that.
Don't touch
right.
the ice,
one
right.
more cube and a shot on top.
There's
right.
a, there, there's
you'd lose your hand if you took the
right. Exactly.
The term is seasoned ice.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, yep. that hasn't happened in 25 years.
Right. There's nothing left.
There's never anything left. As a matter of fact, they're asking for more glasses of this awful ice.
Yeah. Well, there's a great bar in Manhattan called Angel Share. Where they actually take a giant block of ice and chip off pieces of ice, and you get a big block of ice in your cocktail.
Depending on the drink.
Depending on the drink.
When they had ice tools, mm-hmm. there were five or six ice tools to create the type of ice you needed for individual drinks. Now, the cold draft company's still out there. They're still making great machines. And even the machines that the Japanese make can be adjusted. So they have the largest grid, which makes the largest size shape. Then they can be adjusted again so that they don't make what they call shells, a shell
mm-hmm.
is a hollow cube.
Right.
They can make a solid cube. People adjust it to the shell so that they can get more ice faster.
Well, and one of the things that's very interesting is just what you said, Dale, is the benefit is also the problem. As you said, they're cold, dense ice cubes take a long time to freeze, but then they also take a long time to melt back into your drink.
Yes.
You know, and things that are barely frozen and can spit out a lot of you, put them in your drink and they melt pretty quick.
Do you know where the best ice in America is?
Poland Spring,
Alaska.
Your refrigerator at home.
Yeah.
I'm dead serious. You get a better scotch in the rocks in your own home than you'll get in 90% of the bars in America.
Yeah, you don't keep garlic pesto in your fridge, I guess, huh? In your freezer.
Well, you haven't had a garlic pesto martini.
Listen, I have to say something about the last 15-minute segment. We talked a lot about fresh juice, but we never gave your listeners a hint about how to use it in the home. And I want to give them now
Great.
A formula that will make for them what I think to be a sour-style drink that will please 99% of the people that might have a drink at their home. And I'm talking about across the board, a whiskey sour, a Tom Collins, a gin fizz, a margarita. If they use this formula, I think they can be successful in their home. And that is the following. They would take 3/4 of a part. I'm going to use part because I don't know how big their glass is.
You don't need to write this down. We're going to put it all up on our website tonight.
3/4 of a part of the sour ingredient, that could be lemon, lime, or lemon and lime.
Mm-hmm.
They use 1 to 1 1/4 part of the sweet ingredient, depending on your personal taste. One has always worked well for me, but 1/4 of an ounce of the sweet ingredient. Now, the sweet ingredient can be triple sec or Cointreau. If you're making a whiskey sour, it could be simple syrup, which, as the name belies, is really, really easy to make. It's half sugar and half water for beverage application. You just stir it until it dissolves. You don't need to cook it or reduce it or anything.
That's 1 part simple syrup, you said?
Mm-hmm.
If you want it all to dissolve, the water has to be warm.
If you want to, I do it cold or warm. When I was in a hurry at the main room, I'd throw it in a bottle and shake it up, and it would dissolve just as fast cold as it did warm.
All right.
And if you use it rapidly, it's not an issue.
Mm-hmm.
Keep the refrigerator, and it'll slow down the whatever the eventual demise.
Uh huh. So what do I what do we put
finally,
in this
ingredient? Is the strong ingredient, and that of course can vary from the standard 1.5 ounce shot up to 2 ounces, depending. That's not going to change the balance of sweet to sour. It's only going to change the balance of strong. So that formula, 3/4 to 1 to 1.5, I think they'll find really successful for their whiskey sours or their Tom Collinses or whatever.
It's interesting that you bring that up, Dale, because you have when you talk about making a cocktail at home, you talked about balance, and I think that that's very interesting. I'm a big wine guy, and it was only when sitting at your bar that I was like, holy cow, this stuff is really interesting and goes well with food and can be a good companion to my meal or to my evening. How important is balance for you? I mean, what do you look for in a great cocktail?
I think it is the only thing. As in any dish or anything we consume, any sauce, which is really basically a cocktail for food, a sauce. I mean, you know, anything that we make that has flavor and that we enjoy has to have a balance. And I think the mistake that young bartenders make in this era of the martini menus, and that is to say the new age martini menus, the mistake that they make, and it's usually a mistake based on inexperience, is that they err on the side of sweet. Most of their cocktails mm-hmm. are quite sweet. If there is a sweet ingredient, it has to be offset with a sour or bitter ingredient.
It's just like everything we talk about. I mean, Francis and I talk about this almost every day. Everything in balance. Your wine needs to be balanced. Your cocktails need to be balanced as well.
If there's too much acid in the wine, it's a problem. If there's not enough, it's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So, absolutely, I agree completely. And in the sour style drinks, and that encompasses a huge number of drinks, there needs to be this balance. And when you want to set out to create a new drink, you have to think about that too. And that's fun to do. But I would suggest in the home, if you're going to do stuff new and experimental, just get yourself a bowl of mixed fruits.
And a book called Craft of the Cocktail.
Mixing them up into the alcohol.
Well, we're going to come back in just a moment and talk more with Dale DeGroff. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. Time is 11:55. We're back with Dale DeGroff. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Dale, we only have a couple of minutes left, but I want to let people know that you have written, you know, you have one of the best collections of books on the cocktail, and you're probably the preeminent historian of the cocktail in America, I think. And now you've written your own book called...
I'll turn that title over to Dr. Cocktail Ted Hay.
All right.
We're not going to let him have it. We're giving it to you.
Wait, it's my show, Dale. It's our show. Sorry, you're up. But you win. But you've written a book now called The Craft of the Cocktail, which is a fabulous book that sort of has stories in it, and it also has cocktail recipes in it and how to stock your bar at home. How'd that come about?
The stories are to keep you interested as you ply through that, you know, the
tome.
Boring part, which is all the recipes.
Uh-huh.
The book evolved organically out of my experience at the Rainbow Room and all the stories that I accumulated from the Hotel Bel Air and the Rainbow Room over the years.
And you have accumulated quite a few.
Yeah, my association with Joe Baum, who I consider to be a genius in the business, you could write volumes about Joe alone, and the people around him, like Ron Holland, who was his advertising guy for years, who did his restaurant advertising for years, who was also an innovator.
Well, we find this to be, and a lot of people agree that it's one of the best books on the cocktail that's been written in a long time, and certainly for the how-to.
Really great recipes. Just, Dale, we have just a minute or two left, but what I really would like you to tell our listeners is, what kinds of things they can put in their home to stock their bar to be ready for, you know, their parties and have a, you know, a complete bar. And I'm not talking about the liquors. I'm talking about the
lots of fresh fruits and juices,
mm-hmm.
because those things will give you the basis to create and have fun in cocktails of your own. You know, you don't need a huge, broad array of spirits and everything, but get some bitters.
Right.
Get some interesting, you know, Angostura bitters is available in your grocery store.
Right.
Get all the mixers that you need, And then fill out the spirit portion of it depending on what your friends like, what you like. But, you know, something, focus in on a theme, like maybe
mm-hmm.
Brazilian. Maybe you want to mash up some limes into vodka rum or cachaça and go that route. And while you're at it, throw some grapes in with the limes or some cherries.
Or when you're in New Jersey and the strawberries come in, maybe we throw in some strawberries and we'd be seasonal.
Yeah, the watermelon martinis that we made were one of those things that people would flock to.
Stage left was down the block from me in Long Island.
We'll send a car for you, Dale. Anyway, we want to thank Dale DeGroff, the preeminent master bartender in
Dale,
America.
Thanks so much for being here today.
Pleasure.
It was a pleasure to have you. So we're going to put up on our website later on a bunch of different websites. We're going to put up drinkboy.com. We're going to put up cocktaildatabase.com so you can get all sorts of recipes. You can buy Dale's book through us at restaurantguysradio.com. We'll link you to our site where you can buy that.
We're going to put up that recipe for the tequila sunrise.
And we're going to put up how to stock your bar at home, so you'll get all kinds of it, and how to make simple syrup, which is the magic ingredient. I'll write a little piece on simple syrup, too, and a lot of different ways that we can use it. And alcohol
In your iced tea.
In alcohol and in other ways as well. You've been listening to The Restaurant Guys with our bartender, Dale DeGraff, preeminent bartender in America. I am Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark.